Career Curves is pleased to have Groove, maker of the Career Clarity Toolkit, as our sponsor. Are you feeling stuck or trying to figure out what's next in your career? The Career Clarity Toolkit uses design thinking, guided reflection, and career experiments to give you confidence. Go to careercurves.com/groove to get started. As a special promotion for Career Curves listeners, use the discount code CURVES to receive 10% off your first order. How do you bounce back from an early setback? Our guest today knows. He was on the path to do what many people dream of doing, making it into the big leagues as a professional athlete, and then an injury cut his pro career short. Welcome to Career Curves, where we talk to people who have interesting careers and explore how they got where they are today. I'm your host, Beth Davies. Today we're joined by Mike Robbins, who has reinvented himself a number of times. First as a baseball player, then as an account executive selling online ads, and now as an author and motivational speaker. Mike shares his personal experiences and what he's learned about the importance of being true to yourself. Mike, welcome to Career Curves.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
One of the places that we like to start is at the beginning and how your childhood influenced your career. Any connections?
My parents split up when I was three, so I was primarily raised by my mother. But some of my earliest memories that have to do with work were my dad worked at a series of different radio stations, but the last station he worked at was here in the Bay Area in San Francisco at KFOG. And I would go in and he would sit me in the recording studio, and I loved it, all the equipment and everything. And I'd put the headset on and I would just get to talk into the microphone. And so I just remember thinking that was like the coolest thing ever. So the earliest memory I have of thinking what I want to do when I get older was I wanted to be on the radio like my dad. So I have my own podcast and us sitting here doing this whenever I get a chance to do that. I'd often just think about my dad's been gone for, gosh, he died in 2001. But that was definitely an influence. My dad also suffered from bipolar disorder, and his depression and his mental illness, ultimately he lost his job and then wasn't working from the time I was probably about seven. So I was raised single mom. We didn't have a lot of money. I knew from an early age, I want to do something that's important to me that I'm passionate about. And I also would love to make a lot of money because nobody around me in our family made a lot of money, and there was a lot of stress about that.
What were some of the early strategies that you had for how you would make that happen for yourself?
Very soon, actually, probably by the age of about six or seven, my family, my mother was a PE teacher. And so sports were really important to her and to my dad. And we watched sports, particularly baseball and the Oakland A's. And so I started, you know, throwing a ball around. My mom taught me how to throw and catch, and I started playing t-ball at seven, and I was pretty good at it. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to play for the Oakland A's and be in the major leagues. And that was kind of, you know, pretty focused on that at age seven, and then stayed on that track for a number of years.
Did anybody ever say to you things like, hardly anybody makes it into the major leagues, Mike, you know, what's your plan B? And did you, as a result, have a plan B?
You know, it's funny. I don't remember as much. I mean, I had some sense of it was hard. But I also kind of, as a kid, it wasn't that I was like overly cocky per se, but I just had this inner sort of confidence. And education was also really important. So my mom had gone to Tufts, my dad had gone to Wesley, and they're both from the East Coast. And sort of this sense of you're going to go to college and you're going to go to a good college. And okay, so I remember asking my mother, I mean, this is sort of 8 years old, Mom, what's the best college in the country? And she says, Harvard. And I say, okay, I'm going to go to Harvard and play baseball. And then I must have been at school or on the schoolyard telling the other kids, I'm going to go to Harvard and play baseball. And some kid said, Harvard doesn't have a very good baseball team. And then I went home and said, Mom, you didn't tell me Harvard's baseball team. And she's like, well, it's the Ivy League. They're really good schools, but not known for sports. And I said, what's the best school in the country that has a good, really good baseball team? And she said, well, that would probably be Stanford. And I said, okay, then I want to go to Stanford and play baseball. And I was like eight. Like, I was a pretty goal-oriented kid. So then I was like, you know, that was my goal. And that continued to be my goal as I went through middle school and high school, and then ultimately got a chance to play at Stanford, which was pretty cool.
Have you continued to be that way, goal-oriented as an adult as well?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, and I think as it's evolved for me over the course of my life, I mean, I think, as you can probably relate to and a lot of people listening to, there's a light side and a dark side to that, right? I mean, the light side is, you know, focused and go make things happen. The dark side is, at least for me, I can get overly obsessed with the outcome and not always enjoy the process as much as I'd like. So I often tell the story that like the day I walked on campus at Stanford was simultaneously one of the most exciting days and most humbling days of my life, because I had been focused on this goal for so many years. I found out I was going in the fall, so November of my senior year in high school, I'm going to Stanford. So that was the track. So I'd been the kid that's going to Stanford for the last 10 months. And then I show up on campus at Stanford and here I am. And then I look around and I had this really basic, but you know, profound thought. And I realized, oh, everybody else got into Stanford too. And all of a sudden I was terrified and like, oh my God. Like, and then I started meeting the other kid. I was like, these people are like way smarter than me. And that's how I felt. And all the people on the baseball team, they're like way more talented than I am. And I immediately started to experience what I now understand is, you know, we call the imposter syndrome, where I was like, how did I get in here? Then I started to see, especially as I got a little older, you know, having goals and going for them can be great, but sometimes accomplishing them can both be exciting and stressful. And almost always, I think this is true with a lot of things in life, you know, they're not what we think they are. At least that's been my experience. I get there and it's like, yeah, it's great. And this wasn't this thing that magically sort of transformed my life and took away that part of me that thought this was going to be the thing that would fill me up. You know what I mean?
It didn't fix everything. It didn't fill you up.
Not at all.
Tell me about imposter syndrome. So here you are in college. Mm-hmm. You made it. You just said you had imposter syndrome. Do you remember what you did back then to work through that imposter syndrome?
That's a good question. I think even in those days, you know, one of my challenges in school always, I remember this even in like junior high school and high school, like, and I was a good student. The whole thing seemed weird to me. Like, why are we learning all this stuff? What's the point of all of this? When am I going to use this? And especially as I'm going through adolescence and feeling all the fear and doubt and insecurity that I felt, that of course every other kid was feeling too, that nobody was talking about.
We don't talk about that though, right?
And the same thing was when I get to college, and it was like, okay, there was all these really smart, talented kids at Stanford, but there seemed to be this missing, like I was yearning to be having deeper conversations about, is anybody else feeling all of this stuff inside that I'm feeling? And I was able to find a few friends in a few places, both guys I played baseball with and a couple of the women that I dated, in places where it felt safe enough to open up to talk about some of these things. And those were always the most meaningful relationships that I had. And that's where I felt the best and the safest. Like, okay, I could be real with them. And then usually what I noticed is when I admitted my own fear, they would respond in kind. And I didn't think they were doing it just to be nice to me. I think, oh, they're genuinely feeling that too, which made me feel like, okay, I'm not crazy. And I like when I look back on it now and I think about the work that I do now and my passion for realness and authenticity and vulnerability, I think it started early in my life. Once I started to realize like, oh, everybody else has their own story and their own struggle and their own challenge, it both made me feel more connected to people and it made me feel less like I was crazy or something was wrong with me.
So I imagine too, that strategy for overcoming imposter syndrome has clearly carried forward for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think even to this day, one of the things that I try to do is like just tell the truth about how I'm actually feeling. I've now learned, I believe if I'm feeling it, I assume someone else is, if not a lot of other people in the environment. You know, I remember like when I was first starting my business, I would go to networking events and I would often go find someone in one of the first conversations I would have, even if it was a stranger, I'm like, hi, my name's Mike. And I would just tell them how scared I was about being at the event. And they would look at me like I was crazy. And they'd like, can we talk about that? And then they'd say the same thing too. And I usually, that would calm me down to know, like, I could say that out loud. This person didn't think I was crazy. And they responded similarly. And then I would just, you know.
Yeah. And I'm not in this alone. Yeah. I'm just not in this alone. Yeah.
Exactly.
So going back to college.
Yes.
So your goal was to get into Stanford and play baseball.
Yes.
So once you got there, did you create a new goal? What happens once you even meet a goal like that?
The ultimate goal, as it related to baseball, was to make it to the major leagues. And I did get drafted by the New York Yankees out of high school, which was an interesting...
Out of high school.
Yeah, which was a very interesting experience. And now this was... when people asked me about that, it was 1992. And the New York Yankees are the New York Yankees. So even if you're not a sports fan, you know, like, the Yankees are a big deal. But the Yankees were in the midst of a stretch between 1981 and 1996. They did not go to the World Series. They did not go to the playoffs. Like, they had a really sort of rough stretch. So that said, though, it was a huge deal. I wasn't really contemplating actually signing with the Yankees at that time for two reasons. One, I really wanted to go to college and get my education. The baseball at Stanford is really good, and I figured if I went there and played, I'd get a chance to get drafted again out of college. But it is, you know, a little bit of a risk. But the other thing was I had a minor injury to my arm my senior year in high school that I was able to pitch with that not very many people knew about. So I it was a reality of like, hey, I hope I can do this for a long time, but if not, it's really important that I get my education. So, but I went into Stanford with the idea, like most of the guys that I played with at Stanford, we all wanted to be there and get our education and play there. But every single person who plays baseball at Stanford wants to play professionally. It's just sort of, that's the next step. So that was really the goal, was to like get drafted, you know, be able to play at Stanford and play well. And then you become eligible to get drafted if you go to a four-year school after your junior year. So it's kind of a three-year plan to like take as many classes, get as many units as possible, try to get a little ahead of, you know, so you can graduate a little early. So if you get drafted as a junior and sign, you can come back your senior year and finish up before you go off to spring training the next year. And that's ultimately what happened for me.
So your end of your junior year, you mm-hmm. do get drafted. What was drafted. That experience like?
Well, it was amazing. I mean, in general, but we were in Omaha, Nebraska at the College World Series, which is the every year that's where the College World Series happens. So it's the National Championship of Baseball. And my junior year, we made it to Omaha, which is a huge goal. None of us on our team had ever been there. So we're in Omaha. And the night of the draft, I get a phone call in the hotel room where we're staying to find out that I've been drafted by the Kansas City Royals. And it was super exciting, although the funny story behind it, I get the call in the room, and my roommate, who was a sophomore, so he's a year younger than me, I say to him, okay, this is super exciting, but I didn't want to talk about it. Because in those days, this is 95, and for people, like, we had moved hotels, and how were all the scouts going to find us? So a lot of the guys on our team, the information in those days, it wasn't like in real time. We didn't have smartphones. So finding out if you got drafted and where you got drafted could potentially literally take like more than 24 hours. They sent telegrams. I mean, it's almost like the Stone Age is to think about. But I knew that some of my teammates were going to also get drafted, but they may not know. And so I told my roommate, listen, I don't want to tell anybody. We were on our way to a banquet that night for the College World Series. And then another one of our teammates, who was also a junior like me, who was on pins and needles wanting to know if he got drafted, calls our room. And I pick up the phone and he's like, Robbins, did you find out if you got drafted or not? And I like couldn't lie. So I told him and I said, don't tell anybody. And then like 10 minutes later, we go down to get on the bus and he told everybody. And so I get like a standing ovation on the bus from everybody except for the couple other guys who are waiting to see if they got drafted. They were so stressed out. So anyway, it ended up being an amazing experience being there in Omaha and getting drafted and finding that out. It was just like a whole sort of dream come true moment.
Unbelievable. Now, one of the things that's interesting about professional sports is that you don't get to pick your team. It's not right. like business where I get to decide, do I want to join company X or company Y?
Yeah.
Are there any feelings there about, is this the team I wanted or didn't want? Or is it just the fact that, look, this is Major League Baseball?
For the most part, we all just want to get drafted. And I mean, sure, it'd be like if I'd gotten drafted by the Oakland A's, the team I grew up rooting for, that would be really exciting. The practical reality, though, in baseball, in those days and even now, is you want to get drafted by a team in a small market, like the Kansas City Royals or the Pittsburgh Pirates or the Minnesota Twins. Because if you sign with a team like that, you have a good chance to make it to the major leagues faster. If you get drafted by the Los Angeles Dodgers or the New York Yankees or the Chicago Cubs or the Boston Red Sox or one of the big market teams, they spend so much money, they go and basically buy free agent players for their major league team. It's very difficult. Even the San Francisco Giants here in the Bay Area, it's hard to make it up through the minor leagues to get there. It can happen. But so I was in a good position. The Royals were really bad. And it was like, hey, that's a great team to get drafted by because I got a shot. If I can play well in the minor leagues, I could get to the major leagues much quicker than if I had actually signed with the Yankees. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. So you get drafted, and the way baseball works is they send you to the minor leagues
yes.
first.
Yeah.
Is that something that you take in and say, okay, this is great because it's part of the learning path? Or is it like, oh, but I'm still not playing? Tell me that experience.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, so for people who don't, so there's actually six levels of the minor leagues, right? So the highest level right before the major league is called AAA, then there's AA, and then you have basically three levels of what's called A ball, and then there's rookie ball. The kids that sign out of high school will usually go to rookie ball, and then the guys that sign out of college will go to what's called short season A ball. And that's where I went. I went up to Spokane, Washington, and most of the other guys on my team were all guys who'd just gotten drafted out of college. But I actually ended up getting moved up about a month in. They moved me up to the low A ball team, which was in the Midwest. And then I go there and it was like, whoa, this was really different. Because these were now guys, some of them who'd played minor league baseball for a few years. It was just a different vibe. And it was great to get moved up. But you start to realize, oh, this is a grind. This is not very sexy. We're not making hardly any money. I made $850 a month my first year in professional baseball. That's it. right? And you know, you get a little signing bonus if you're lucky, and then that's what you have to live on. And you only get paid during the 6 months of the season, so you have to get a job. You know, my first offseason, I had to go back to Stanford to finish my degree. But then the next couple of years when I was still playing in the offseason, I had to go get a job. I was a substitute teacher. I did other random things to try to make a little money, you know. So it's you get to the major leagues, it gets very sexy, very interesting. You make a lot of money. The ballparks are beautiful. You're in big cities. But in the minor leagues, even at AA and AAA, which I never got to because of my injury, it's still not that glamorous.
How do you maintain your self-esteem in this kind of an environment where, especially, it seems like you go from, hey, I'm the top, I'm you know, the best in my in college, so I'm being drafted, and then I go down to the bottom. And so you're getting this kind of message of, you're good, but you're not so good. How do you maintain your self-esteem?
It's tough. You know, I think one of the things that I don't miss about sports is it's a constant, there's a constant pecking order, and it's you're only as good as your last game. You're only, you know what I mean? And it's so numbers driven and statistically driven. I mean, in pro baseball, it's also, I mean, you're literally, it's your height, your weight. And as a pitcher, it's how the velocity. So like every time I'd go out to pitch, there are all these scouts with radar guns and they're literally watching every pitch and writing it down. So you feel like a piece of meat that they're evaluating. And it's like, well, that piece of meat's bigger and better than you. So we're going to take that one and not you. And so it also isn't very team oriented. I mean, I did make some friends and connected with some of the guys, but in college, there was some sense that we were focused on trying to win. We wanted to win the conference, the Pac-10 conference. We wanted to win, go to the, you know, Omaha and win the College World Series. In pro ball, the focus is make it to the major leagues. So the truth is, your teammates are actually your biggest competition. So the other pitchers on my own team, it's like, they're not going to call all of us up to the next level. They're only going to call one or two of us. So I want to do better. So it was pretty intense. And I had to learn how to train myself to not root against my teammates, because personally, like, it didn't feel good to me. But I also became more introspective in those days. I started reading more. I started writing in a journal, which I'd never really done much of. And so it was interesting. I mean, I look back on it now and realize it was a lot of personal growth for me during that time, but also a lot of fear and angst, because I really wanted to make it. And I was also really scared that I wouldn't.
And so then you actually had an injury that took you out.
Yeah. So I was pitching. Did you ever see the movie Bull Durham?
Do I dare admit that I have
you not?
Oh, I know. It's a great, horrible.
Well, so it was late 80s, you know, Kevin Costner and Tim Robbins and Susan Sarandon. It's a great movie. I highly recommend.
I've heard great things about it. I don't know why I haven't seen
it. Well, literally, I mean, it takes place in the town of Durham, right? And Durham, North Carolina, and the team is called the Durham Bulls. And so I actually, my last year in pro ball, I played for the Wilmington Blue Rocks in Wilmington, Delaware, but I was in the Carolina League. And the night I got hurt, I was actually pitching against the Durham Bulls. You know, when I got injured, I mean, I'd had some injuries previous. And then the night that I got hurt, finally, it was pretty significant, and I knew it. I mean, I threw one pitch, and it literally felt like someone shot a gun through my elbow, and I couldn't even straighten my arm. I came off the mound. I went home that night with ice on and woke up the next morning. And then I had what's called Tommy John surgery or reconstructive elbow surgery that summer. This was 97. And, you know, so at that point, I knew I was going to be out for – this is about a year-long rehab when you have this surgery. And people come back from it. There's a lot of pitchers in the major leagues who've had it done. And even 20 plus years ago, there was a pretty decent success rate. And at the same time, it's pretty significant. So I knew there was a chance my career was in jeopardy. And then I went back to spring training the next year, and the Royals ended up releasing me, which basically means they kind of gave up on me. They said, well, you know what, you might recover from the surgery, but, you know, good luck. See you later. So now I was still rehabbing from the injury. I came back home. I ended up having another operation on my elbow because I was still having some pain. And I had also torn the labrum, which is the cartilage in my shoulder. So I had a shoulder surgery and then rehab from both of those with the idea that maybe I could still come back. But I now was not under contract with any team. So that was a whole journey and a whole process that, you know, I had to go through both physically, but then mentally and emotionally.
Yes, because you've been released. You'd been making essentially no money, even though you were in the minors. You're right. Back now at home. You're injured.
Yes.
And so here you are, this highly goal-oriented person who's probably had a personal low at this particular point.
It was rough because it was my identity. My life had been oriented around baseball. On an ego level, I had a really good story to tell. And then all of a sudden, I get hurt, and it's like, oh, I don't have a very good story to tell. And as almost even as I say it now, as shallow as that sounds, I realized so much of my life had been run by this thing that, like, I had a good story to tell, whether I was really happy or miserable, that even if I met you at a cocktail party or at a family gathering or a barbecue, I could say, oh, well, and people are now interested. Even if they're not sports fans, it's still an interesting story. That when I ultimately, and it took me a while, and I actually got a job, my first job in the fall of 98, working in technology, but I still had not fully acknowledged that I wasn't going to play baseball anymore. And I still was holding out hope that maybe that spring of 99, I would go down to Arizona and work out for some teams and get picked up and go back and play. And then I'd quit my tech job and go back into baseball.
So you were still Mike, the baseball player.
Right.
I'm just right now biding a little bit of time, but I'm still that same. That's still Mike, the baseball player.
Yeah. So I get the job for this company called 24/7 Media in the fall of 1998. This is sort of dot-com boom time. This company basically reps a bunch of like 600 different websites and sells their ad space. Their banner ads was what they were selling at the time. And I don't know anything about working, and let alone even like using a laptop.
How did you get the job?
The guy who hired me, a guy named Stephen Comfort, great guy. I got connected to him through someone from the Stanford Alumni Network. And Stephen had gone to North Carolina, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and was a left-handed pitcher at UNC. And we get on the phone and he looks at my resume and he's like, baseball, what position? Pitcher, what, lefty? Oh, and then we have the interview and we talk baseball the whole interview. And he's like, I love hiring athletes. You can figure this job out in sales. And like, he offered me like a sales assistant role, and I negotiated because I got some coaching from someone else. And then he's like, he was impressed that I negotiated. And then he gave me an inside sales job, you know, and I'm like, okay. And I was like excited, but now I don't know, what the heck does this mean? I don't even know what to do. Still hoping that I can go back and play baseball. And then that sort of 3 months into that job, I was back pitching. I had rehabbed from my surgeries, but I was in so much pain. But I went out to dinner in North Beach in San Francisco the night of my 25th birthday with my mom and my sister. I don't think my dad was with us, and my girlfriend at the time. And I told them, very teary-eyed, I'm retiring from baseball. Like, I can't do it anymore. But it was really hard. And that was kind of how baseball ended for me.
Did it help at all that you had this ad sales job, or were those really compartmentalized for you in two different things?
You know, I mean, it did in the sense that I had a job, I was making a little bit of money. I figured, you know, it was a practical way of moving on with my life, but it was, I didn't know what the heck I was doing. I didn't know why I was doing it. I didn't, you know, but again, it seemed like, well, I'm in the Bay Area. This is what's happening. The dot-com thing is happening. I was more focused, actually, quite frankly, on the girlfriend that I had at the time. She and I had this really on-again, off-again, very rocky relationship. And I was just trying to, like, I didn't want to, like, lose baseball and get my heart broken sort of back-to-back, which is ultimately what ended up happening. But I was trying to sort of hang on to the relationship for some sense of stability. But through that whole process, within a few months amount of time, baseball ended and my relationship ended, and here I was living at home with my mother, which, you know, I like to say when I talk about it now, it's like that's what a lot of kids do coming out of college these days, and there's no shame about it, and that's just what happens. That's the economic reality. That was not the case for me at that time. Like, people didn't go back to live with their parents unless there was a problem. So I was living with my mother in the house that I grew up in Oakland and driving into San Francisco for this job, you know, doing online ad sales, which I didn't really know what the heck I was doing and why I was doing it.
So how did you ultimately pull yourself back up?
You know, what happened though for me in that process was I got really interested and even more deeply interested in personal growth and development. So it was like, you know, I had seen a good therapist when I was in college. I had struggled with some of my own depression and knowing about mental illness from my dad and my family. But I also got really interested in reading books. I was reading books by people like Wayne Dyer and Marianne Williamson and these sort of spiritual teachers, Thomas More and Carolyn Mace. And it was all like sort of personal growth, but, you know, metaphysics and about health. Because I also got interested, like, how come my arm didn't get better when I went to the doctor and they did the things and the surgeries and gave me all the medicines and all the exercises? It was like, maybe there was something, there was some mind-body connection to that. And I mean, I just started asking some deeper questions, and it led me to, I started taking a bunch of personal growth workshops. It's where I ultimately met my wife, Michelle. And I just got really interested in that work, both personally, because it was helping me as I was going through all of this difficult stuff. But there was a community of people, and people were getting real, and they were talking about real stuff and how they really felt. And I was like, oh my gosh, you can talk like this. You can engage like this.
I've wanted this since I was in college.
Exactly. And then not only were people doing that, I was like, there are people that teach this. But I was like, how do you get to do that? I want to do that. And then I started getting really interested. Like, what are the qualifications of people who write books like this? What does it take to, when I'd go see someone speak or I'd go to one of these workshops and someone was facilitating the workshop, I'm like, how did they get trained to get up there and lead the workshop? Because I think I want to do that. And that's what started to really pull me through. And in a way, I often use it, again, it's like when you get your heart broken in a relationship, it's like you have to go through the process of grieving the loss. But usually, at least in my experience of heartbreak, it ultimately finally ends when you fall in love with someone else, right? At least that's been my experience. And so for me, it was like, it took me a few years, but falling in love with my own sort of growth and development and then wanting to do that to inspire other people was what helped kind of pull me through. And, you know, to this day, I'm just so grateful for that.
And so what were some of those steps that you needed to take to get yourself into this field of writing books, speaking about personal growth,
right?
Speaking about authenticity, authentic self?
Well, I worked for 24/7 for a year and a half, had some success there, you know, but it was, and then got hired by this company called Rivals.com that was a sports website based up in Seattle. They were expanding. They were going to go public. They wanted to open up sales offices in all the big markets around the country. And so they hired me and paid me like twice what I was making and all these stock options. And it was like, okay, cool. I'm going to get rich. Like some of my friends were working for these companies that were going public and they were all getting rich. And I was like, well, that'll be cool.
And that was one of your goals as a kid.
Yeah. Hey, I'll make some money. I didn't love what I was doing, but I'll keep doing this, learn some skills. If I can make some money and leverage that. The long-term goal was like, maybe down the road in 5 years or so, if I have some success and learn some things, maybe I can start writing and speaking. And I don't know what that looks like. I still don't know how one gets qualified to do that. But and then the dot-com bubble burst in the spring of 2000 when the NASDAQ crashed. And I ended up, that was right when I got the new job. And I got laid off in July. So like three months later after getting this new job, we were going to go public. It was all going to go great. Not only did that not happen, but I was out of work. And it was, you know, I often say everybody by that fall and then the next year into early 2001, everybody who was my age who was working in technology was getting laid off. But when I got laid off in July, it wasn't yet cool. It was like super scary because now I'm like, well, what am I going to do? And then I had a mentor of mine say to me, well, if you could do anything, what would you do? If you didn't have to worry about paying the bills, you could just do what you wanted. I said, well, I would speak and I would write and I would share anything that I've learned and anything I'm learning and anything from my story with other people in a way that might inspire them. And he was like, you seem really clear. You should do that. And I was like, now? And he said, yeah, well, why not? And I said, well, because I'm 26 years old and I don't know anything and nobody knows who I am. And like, I don't even know how you make money doing that. And he's like, well, you could wait till you figured it out or you could just do it now. And so like that was the beginning of a process for me. I still kind of, the rest of that year, I was half-heartedly looking for a job. It was hard to find a job. Everybody my age was out of work. Nobody was hiring. And then I met Michelle, my wife, who had started her own staffing company a few years earlier. And she really encouraged me. And she was like, look, starting your own business is not that easy, but it's not as hard as you think. And you have a real gift and you're really passionate and you can do it. And so with her encouragement and a few other mentors, and I just decided in 2001, the beginning of 2001, I'm going to start my own business. And I had a little bit of a plan. People were giving me advice, go to school, go back to school, get a master's or a PhD in psychology or organizational development. I love to learn, never loved school. And so I thought, if I have to, I will. But my idea was I was going to design my own curriculum, is what I called it, for a year. Take every workshop I could afford, read every book, listen to every cassette tape in those days. I still had my Sony Walkman that I loved and right, learn as much as I could, meet people, anyone I met who was coaching, who was teaching, who was speaking, who was writing, who was facilitating, take them out to coffee and just pick their brain. How did you start? How do you make money? Who do you know? Use the network that I had from baseball, from Stanford, from sales, and just, you know, do whatever I could for a year. And I figured at the end of that year, I'd probably be broke and I might even be in debt. But if I went back to school, I was going to be broken in debt anyway. And I figured at the end of it, if I couldn't get any business and I wasn't generating any money doing this, then I'll go find a job. It was lean the first couple of years, but I did get lucky in the sense that there were a ton of companies here in the Bay Area, you know, like Wells Fargo, Kaiser, Chevron, who were hiring people who were young like me. And they'd want me to come in and speak about how do you work with people who are different and how do we create sort of, you know, a culture of teamwork and collaboration, which was something I was just interested in from my years playing baseball and growing up in Oakland in diverse environments. So And then things went well in some of these places and they liked what I said or how I said it. And then they'd ask me to come back. And I'm like, really? Okay. So then I just kept coming back whenever I would get, you know, I literally would go speak anywhere. Like I'd go talk at the Rotary Club in Mill Valley, California or wherever. And it was amazing. I'd go talk at some Little League event. And like I spoke at a Little League event in Palo Alto and like one of the dads comes up and I'm the CEO of this company. Could my team's really, you know, okay. So that was like how it started to happen. And I just kept sort of following where it was taking me and, you know.
So it sounds like initially you weren't even necessarily picking your exact topic. You know, like you're saying here, like they're looking for somebody to help break down some generational barriers. Come talk about that. At what point were you able, did you recognize that you were able to shift it and start to say, you know something, I can actually craft my own message and go after that?
You know, what's interesting is it's for me, it's always been, I'm passionate about all the different topics that I've written books about. But for me, it's always been about the relationship and the connection with people. And so, and it's not to say that I don't think the content's important or the topic's important, but it's always been for me, like when I connect with a person or a team or a group, kind of getting a sense of what's needed, if that makes sense. Uh-huh. And do I have anything to offer that I think might benefit this person if I'm coaching someone or this group, if I'm working with a team or, and that started, and I was telling my story. And the thing for me with my story about baseball, what I realized in reflecting on the experience after it was over was the only regret that I had from it wasn't that I didn't make it to the big leagues, wasn't that I didn't end up, you know, pitching at Yankee Stadium and making millions of dollars. I mean, those were disappointments, but I didn't regret that because I had given it everything that I had.
That's such a great distinction.
Yeah, the difference between, like, you can be disappointed. I was deeply disappointed. I was devastated. I was super sad. I really wanted it. To this day, I wish I would have had the experience of pitching at Yankee Stadium. That would have been cool. There are still moments. I have dreams sometimes that I'm in the major leagues pitching, and I wake up in the morning, and my first reaction is sadness. It's like, oh, that would have been really cool. I wish I could have had that experience, and I didn't. However, I didn't regret it because I gave it my all. I put my heart and soul into it. The only regret that I had, though, was I didn't fully appreciate it while it was happening. I was stressed out. I was worried I wasn't going to make it. I was comparing myself to everyone around me. I was holding my breath, you know, trying not to screw up. And it was like, when it was finally over, I was able to say, without being arrogant, like, you know what? I was pretty good at that. I worked really hard at that. I should have enjoyed that more because, like, it took me to places I never would have. I mean, even to this day, I'm so grateful for my baseball career because in a lot of ways, it's allowed me to do some of what I do now. But I was so goal-oriented. This is the dark side of being so goal-oriented. I said to myself, I'll appreciate it when I make it. I mean, my coach at Stanford, who I respect, used to say, there was a saying, he would say, get there, then rest. That was the mentality of like, you get there, right? And there's some wisdom in that, like work really hard, get there, then you celebrate. But it was that mentality that actually kind of bit me in the butt, if you will, because I didn't rest, I didn't relax, I didn't enjoy it enough. And so I said to myself, I want to learn from that. I don't want to do that as I move forward in my life. And you know what? I know a lot of people can't necessarily relate to playing professional baseball like me, but I bet a lot of people can relate to not appreciating what they have while they have it until after the fact. And then that became, oh, this is universal. So this whole, my work around appreciation became, how do we appreciate what we have while we have it? And then I started thinking about who were the best coaches I played for? Who were the best teams I was on? The best teammates? They were always the ones who I felt like they valued me and they cared about me. So that became part of the message. And then ultimately, the first book that I wrote, Focus on the Good Stuff, was about that. But it's continued to evolve, like the topics, authenticity or compassion or, you know, how do we move through and create change? And then some of the topics around leadership and things, I mean, they've more evolved just from my own growth. I still look at it from the standpoint of like, I'm just trying to figure some things out. I'm just paying attention to what I see out there. Let me offer to you my perspective and hopefully it might be helpful to you. And then you can take it and do whatever you want to do with it because you have a different life and a different set of challenges and goals than I do. But let's see what works.
It's such a great story because you shared how you overcame the imposter syndrome in college, which was by making the connections. And mm-hmm. here you are and you figured out how to keep fueling yourself and fueling others by making that connection. But just now sometimes you do it in larger group settings as opposed to one-on-one, but it's still human to human connection.
Well, and one of the things that I've learned, you know, and that helps me now, even when I find myself in situations where I am a little nervous or intimidated, is I think at the end of the day, it's like something I heard Oprah say many years ago that I thought was so great. She said, you know, I've interviewed all these people. presidents and prime ministers and celebrities and, you know, all types of people. And she said, after almost all the interviews I've ever done, she said, just about every single person asks me some version of the same question. When the interview's over, the camera shuts off and they lean over and they say, how'd I do? Or was that okay? Right? And she said, you know, early in my career, I used to be really confused by this question because I'd be sitting across from like someone who's really successful and accomplished and wondering like, are they really that insecure? Like, do they really need, why are they asking for my validation? She goes, then I realized something. They're not actually asking if they did okay, or if they're asking, did you see me? Did you hear me? Did what I say matter to you? And she said, and I agree with her, I think everybody's asking those questions. And so what I feel like, what I try to remind myself, and not in some sort of holier than thou way or in some hyperbolic way, but just, can I see people and hear people and let them know you matter? And can I encourage or inspire other people to, like, if we do that for each other, that's what people really want. So do you want to be a great leader and have impact on people? We'll see them and hear them and let them know they matter, right? Do you want to go do something really great in your life, whatever the goal may be? We'll see how you can engage with other people in a way that it's beneficial to them. But like, the things that are the most important and the biggest things, like, we can't do them alone, you know? And I think back to my desire from childhood and all the way through, it's like wanting to connect with people human to human, that it always makes me feel better and safer with other humans. Even if I really respect and admire and impressed by someone and their accomplishments or their intelligence or what they've done, it's when they sort of, as I like to say, lower the waterline on the iceberg and we get down to some deeper stuff of what's really going on. Then it's like, oh, you know what? We're not that different. There's so much connection that we have as human beings. And, you know, as simple as that is, I actually think in today's world, with how fast we're moving and all the great technology we have that allows us to have this conversation and people can listen to it all over the world instantaneously on different devices, like, the art and the skill of being able to connect human to human is so important. And I think it's going to continue to be one of, if not the most important things for all of us. And it's easy. I watch myself too. It's easy to almost like forget, because I'm staring at screens all day and I'm interacting with technology and I'm trying to move at the pace that life is moving.
Yep.
So it's a challenge.
You mentioned before that when you were on the baseball journey, mm-hmm. that you weren't recognizing that you were on the journey and you were so focused on the end goal.
Yes.
Where are you in the journey now? Where are you?
It's a great question. You know, I would say I definitely still struggle with it. I know better, and I would say there are definitely aspects of my life and my work that I'm more mindful and I'm more conscious. One of the things I notice as a father, you know, we have two girls, Samantha, who's 13, and Rosie, who's 10. And I have these moments, and I'm sure this is true for anybody who has children, but I just wake up and look and go, oh my God, like, how did that happen? I swear it was like last week I was swaddling them as babies and wondering about it. When are they going to walk? And like, and here it's like, you know, now Samantha's like 3 inches taller than Michelle. And, you know, I mean, these things happen. And so it has me stop and pause. But at the same time, I can see that my own tendency to be really focused on the goals and the outcome and the success and the, like, I'm working on a new book right now and wanting to be great. And I have to constantly manage myself to stop and slow down and pay attention to what really matters. You know, sitting here in my office where we're doing this interview, it's like to sit and look out the window and from time to time go, oh my gosh, like, be grateful for this. Yeah.
So I do have the pleasure of sitting in your office right now, and I hope as you sit here and you look around that your eyes go to this picture that's here on the wall,
hand-painted
by one of your daughters.
Yes.
I don't know which one.
Rosie.
And it says, Daddy, I know you loved me since I was born, but I've loved you for my whole life.
Yeah.
And so, right, talk about appreciating the moment, and also talk about passing your message of appreciation, you know, to your children. That's just such a special piece of art that you have there.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you pointing it out. I mean, in part of, you know, getting it when she gave it to me a few years ago, it was so sweet. And then putting it up, I mean, that's another like physical reminder, or even, you know, this behind me asking the question, you know,
what do you appreciate in your life right now?
Yeah. And so those kinds of things.
For me right now, what do I appreciate in my life right now is you giving us this time and sharing your story. And I've really enjoyed it. And I know there's been a couple of times for me where I've had a hard time finding my next question because I'm like in the moment, like sucking in what you just said. And I'm like, wait, I've got another role I'm supposed to play. I'm supposed to be interviewing.
Right.
I do have a couple final questions for you. What would you say was the smartest career move that you made, whether intentionally or accidentally, and why?
I think starting my business as young as I did. It was scary. I wasn't really prepared, but I had people say to me, you know, you're young, you're not married, you don't have a mortgage, you can take some risk. If it doesn't work out, you'll be okay. And I kind of got it intellectually, but I get it now at 45 years old with two children looking back going, oh yeah, if I were trying to do it now, not impossible, but a lot harder and a lot scarier.
If you could have one do-over, what would it be?
You know, ironically, I would say earlier on, I wish I would have joined a team or built a team or somehow, I'm such a team-oriented person, but I couldn't, nobody was hiring at that time. And I mean, I really started because it was like the last resort. You know what I mean? I was looking for like a small consulting firm that could hire me and mentor me and I could apprentice or something. But, and I think then because things were lean and because I have this sort of scrappy personality, I just sort of did it myself. And I wish I would have teamed up and partnered up in a way earlier on and sort of built something of that of my own, but also with other people.
What's one piece of career advice that you would like to give your younger self?
Relax. just relax and trust yourself. Enjoy every step of the process. I mean, I think that I'd give that advice to myself at a younger age about career, but also about parenting, about marriage, about just about everything.
And the last question, how do you define success?
That's a good question. I think I define success by doing what you love and loving what you do.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Mike, thank you so much. Again, I so appreciate this moment and having you in my life right now.
Oh,
so thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
A quick epilogue. Mike has written 4 books, Focus on the Good Stuff, Be Yourself, Everyone Else is Already Taken, Nothing Changes Until You Do, and his most recent, Bring Your Whole Self to Work. He's also the host of the podcast, Bring Your Whole Self to Work. Links can be found on our website, careercurves.com. While you're there, check out our other resources, join the conversation, or send us a comment. Thanks for being part of the Career Curves community.